Ah, welcome. Come in. Take a seat. Tea? No? What can I do for you then? Ah, I take it you're here for a story, yes? Very well. Which one today? Let me think. Ah, yes. Let me tell you of a story that is stranger than fiction. The true story of two men caught in terrible conditions with the greatest stakes of all. This is the story of one man who took us to the brink of nuclear war and another who saved us from it. This is the story of Vasily Arkhipov and Valentin Savitsky. Autumn 1962. The height of the Cold War between the Americans and the USSR, the United Soviet States of Russia. Kennedy had previously ordered more than 100 US-built missiles to be deployed in Italy and Turkey. These missiles had the capability to strike Moscow with the nuclear warheads with a simple flip of a switch. In retaliation, the Soviet command created Operation Anadir, the covert placement of warheads and mechanized divisions on Cuban soil. The island of Cuba is only technically 228 miles away from the American city of Miami. For Soviet Premier Khrushchev, this was effectively threatening America in their own backyard. However, in order to get the missiles to Cuba, the Soviets needed to deceive the Americans. They hid the missiles within their transport ships, beneath grain and other agricultural equipment. Though they can't find anything suspicious, the Americans were on high alert, increasing their spy plane output and intelligence collection. The Cuban residents saw the missiles, and the information filtered back through to the US. But no hard evidence was found. Yet. Why so many missiles? Well, both the Americans and the Soviets were living in the time of mass paranoia. The Americans were building bomb shelters in their gardens and living with the fear of nuclear war every day. Just imagine if you were at school at that time. You'd be having a history lesson and then suddenly, you'd have to scramble to get on your knees under the tiny desk. Think about what that was like. Forever living in fear of absolute destruction? World War II was not that long ago. And the Americans remembered what they had done to Japan at Nagasaki and Hiroshima. The fear was in their blood now, and it would not let them go. What? What about Vasily and Valentin? Ah. Yes. I was just getting to them. They were part of Anadir, a sub-operation called Operation Karma. Oh, and Anadir and Karma are rivers in Russia. Clever, huh?
October the 1st, 1962. The Soviet 69th Brigade, made up of four diesel electric submarines, known by the Americans as the Foxtrot-class submarines, are told to leave their Arctic base with their orders only to be opened once at sea. On board the submarine designated B-59 is Vasily Arkhipov, commander of the fleet, and Valentin Savitsky, captain of the B-59. Little did either know that soon enough the fate of the world would rest in their hands. Their orders were as follows. They were to make best speed and remain undetected in order to make it to Cuba, where they would be permanently stationed from now on. It was a 7,000-mile trip in a small metal box that stank of diesel and acid, with the constant danger of being detected. But that wasn't all. Unbeknownst to all but the captains, fleet commander, and political officers, each submarine carried what was known as a special weapon. A nuclear torpedo with the same destructive power as the Hiroshima bomb. Each captain had been given authority to act without Moscow's permission if the situation demanded it. There was one safeguard, though. In general, two people, the captain and the political officer, held two parts of the key needed to unlock the firing mechanism to launch the missile. However, on B-59, there were three, as fleet commander Vasily Arkhipov held the right of veto. Under the constant threat of detection, they spent the next 2 weeks travelling to the mid-Atlantic undetected. By this time, the US was starting to really get worried, and they'd sent out 85% of their Atlantic fleet in order to curb the Soviets. 40 destroyers, 4 aircraft carriers, and 258 aircraft were searching for any and all Soviet ships. And then they found the missiles on Cuba.
Let me ask you one simple question. Do you, Ambassador Zorin, deny that the USSR has placed and is placing medium and intermediate range missiles and sites in Cuba? Yes or no? Don't wait for the translation. Yes or no?
Я не нахожусь в американском суде, и поэтому не хочу отвечать на вопрос, который задается прокурорском плане.
Put to me in the fashion in which prosecutor does. In due course, sir, you will have your reply.
You're in a court of world opinion right now, and you can answer yes or no. You have denied that they exist. I want to know if I've understood you correctly.
I should like to
say, sir, would you please continue your statement? You will have your answer in due course.
Stevenson, would you continue your statement, please? You will receive the answer in the due course.
I'm prepared to wait for my answer until hell freezes over, if that's your decision.
It was at that point that Kennedy feared the worst and decided to blockade Cuba, though under the less threatening term of quarantine.
Good evening, my fellow citizens. This government, as promised, has maintained the closest surveillance of the Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba. Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island. The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere. Upon receiving the first preliminary hard information of this nature, last Tuesday morning at 9 a.m., I directed that our surveillance be stepped up. And having now confirmed and completed our evaluation of the evidence and our decision on a course of action, this government feels obliged to report this new crisis to you in fullest detail.
And thus, the Cuban Missile Crisis began. However, on the B-59, they had no clue of what was happening. The 14th of October had seen Hurricane Ella crossing the Atlantic, leading to 5 to 7 meter waves, and the wind was even worse. Though it grounded the US spotter planes, allowing the submarines to get through undetected, it was a living hell inside the submarine itself. Akin to being put into a washing machine on fast spin, they were tossed and turned inside a tiny space, one they'd already been living in for more than 2 weeks, without any contact with Mother Russia. But finally, on the 15th of October, change of mission. You are to stay in the Sargasso Sea and wait for further instructions. Ah, well, yeah, there was a problem with that. Not only did you have the Atlantic Fleet sniffing you out like a cat outside a mouse hole, but there was a problem with the submarines themselves. You see, they were made for cold environments, like the Arctic where they were based. 37 degrees Fahrenheit, or just above freezing. Not 80 degrees. Once they got to the Sargasso Sea, the coldest area of the submarine was 110 degrees. And did those men feel every degree? A week and a half later, 3 weeks into their voyage, the men of the B-59 submarine are beginning to wear thin. They've had no communication from Moscow since being ordered to stay in the Sargasso Sea. Though Hurricane Ella has helped them shelter from the US fleet, there's still a great risk of being found. In fact, the only thing saving them at that moment is the hurricane and the wildly changing temperature of the water.
Hmm? Ah, well, that's down to the sonar, you see. Sonar is what we use to track objects underwater. It's like bats using sound to see. Echolocation. You make a high-pitched noise and you see what it reflects from. If you've ever been swimming, you'll know that the deeper down you go, the colder it gets. These are called isothermic layers, and normally sonar can see through them. However, in a storm situation like this, all the heat layers are messed up, and the increased density between the hot and cold layers means that the sonar just bounces right off. A clever submarine captain uses that to hide their boat. Cool, huh?
The stink of diesel and acid permeates the submarine as the air condition has failed, and they're down to rationing each submariner to only a single glass of water a day. The coldest area of the boat is 110 degrees, and the only information they're getting is from Miami radio.
The United States' answer to what Adlai Stevenson termed Soviet blackmail in Cuba was a quarantine of all offensive weapons being shipped from Russia to that island fortress. The U.S. threw up a steel fence, prepared to stop any vessel carrying materials of war. In Cuba itself, 100,000 men were put under emergency orders as they had been during past invasion scares. The waterfront in Havana and along other parts of the coast bristled with gun emplacements as the Cuban regime waited to see what their bosses in the Kremlin were to do. Cuba became the focus of world attention. Here centered the most critical threat of global war since the surrender of Germany 17 years ago.
October 24th. Still no new orders, and the weather has begun to settle. Their batteries are low when the US spotter plane passes overhead. Engaging the emergency dive, they pray they haven't been spotted. They've only got 6 hours of battery power left. Only 6 hours that they can stay underwater. But not even there is safe anymore. With the calming of the seas, the isothermic layers have settled down, and it's only a matter of time until the submarine is spotted. October 27th, an American spy plane is shot down over Cuba, killing Major Rudolph Anderson, the only official casualty of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Tensions between West and East rise even higher. Kennedy decides to order the fleet to force the B-59 submarine to surface using depth charges. Kennedy informs the Soviets of his plans regarding the submarine.
Depth charges? Well, imagine dropping a grenade in a pond. Same idea. In fact, in Russia there was a code of 3 depth charges to force a submarine to surface. Sadly, the US didn't have the same code.
October 28th. Now the crew of the B-59 submarine are boiling, starving, tired, and completely cut off from their commanders. They've been found, and explosions are going off all around them. The US have no intention of killing the submariners, but they don't know that. And then the US starts to use sonar as an offensive weapon. Frightened and confused, Vasily Arkhipov and Venetin Savitsky have heard nothing from Mother Russia. Explosions are happening around them, and they are running out of time. Five hours this went on before Valentin Savitsky decided they had no choice. "Load the special weapon," he cried. "We will destroy the fleet, but we will not fail Russia."
The political officer handed over his key, and the world was on a knife edge. With one press, nuclear war would be declared. Stop! As commander of the fleet, Arkhipov had veto authority on the launch, and despite the situation, he had kept his cool. He looked at the captain, Valentin Savitsky, and said, "I am in command of this fleet, and I will not allow you to launch that missile." Valentin Savitsky replied that we have no option. But Vasily said, "Yes, we do. We will surface and contact Moscow." Arkhipov was well aware of the damage nuclear weapons could do to people. He was part of the crew of the K-19 nuclear submarine that had a leak in its cooling system. Despite stopping a nuclear meltdown, the crew was affected by a great deal of radiation. All the members of the engineer crew and their divisional officer died within a month due to the high levels of radiation they were exposed to. Over the course of 2 years, 15 more sailors died from the after effects. It may have been his involvement in the K-19 incident that gave him the edge in this argument against Savitsky and the political officer, but his cooler head prevailed and they surfaced. And that is how one man saved us all from almost certain nuclear war. What happened to him? Well, perhaps unsurprisingly, the crew of the B-59 submarine were hardly hailed as heroes on their return. Arkhipov continued in the Soviet Navy service, commanding submarines and later submarine squadrons. He was promoted to Rear Admiral in 1975, and became head of the Kirov Naval Academy. Arkhipov was promoted to Vice Admiral in 1981 and retired in the mid-1980s. He subsequently died on the 19th of August 1998. The radiation to which Arkhipov had been exposed in 1961 contributed to his death. Savitsky? Well, I imagine he retired into disgrace. Or perhaps not. Who can say? In fact, the world didn't know anything about this until 40 years afterwards, in 2002, when the documents detailing this exchange were released to the public. And thus, Vasily Arkhipov had been forgotten. But we know who he is now, don't we? We know who to thank the world not coming to an end on that day in October of 1962. Now, be off with you. I have a cat to feed and tea to make.